Welcome to Listings Tales from the Script. I'm Tom Moore. This is the second in our monthly series of performance prose podcasts celebrating the art and craft of writing and storytelling. And today our guest writer is the charming Lindsay May, who will be reading her excellent story written especially for Listink on the theme of medicine. Medicine will be a theme familiar with regular attendees of Listink, as it was the theme for our event in May, Verbal Medicine. I like to introduce our themes with a little fact, and this time I've picked an oldie but a goodie, that the first form of surgery ever recorded is trepanning. That's having a hole drilled in your skull, if you didn't know, and it's been performed as far back as 6500 BC. It's all been downhill from there. Our theme thoroughly established, I'm passing over the mic to Lindsay May so she can read us her story.
Mistress of Medicine. In Hall 16, I was the undisputed Mistress of Medicine. It started small, always the good girl scout with the pop cap of paracetamol, roll of cough sweets, or flattened plaster in the bottom of my bag. But by the time first year was drawing to a close, I was indispensable. Hall 16 was populated exclusively by arts and politics students, singularly lacking in common sense, and quite clearly unable to do without me. I was the only girl on our floor who was without family money, and was presumably drawn to art history by a yearning to put past masters in their place. It soon occurred to me that with the help of my queenly medicine cabinet, the same could be done for the leaders of the future. Before the first term was over, I'd fully exploited my organisational abilities and had a steady stream of lazy students at my door. My most frequent visitor was anorexic Angelica, who was rather volatile and needed a steady supply of laxatives, sedatives, and antiseptic wipes. I had been known to occasionally, and she was looking especially peaky, file down a handful of vitamins until they could be concealed amongst her normal rattle of pills. But she noticed once, and almost had me with the jagged edge of a Perrier bottle. I only gave her what she asked for after that. Most of the students under my care had simple desires. Hassle-free Clopas and ibuprofens, which I stocked up on in the pound shops they were too posh to visit. Then there were the special somethings only available on prescription, which weren't much of a problem for me, having quickly discovered a real knack for displaying the symptoms of a wide range of embarrassing and somewhat disturbing illnesses. I never charged over the odds. In fact, plenty of my ministrations were technically free. There was only one defector in Hall 16, Equinox, who was rumoured to have been christened Marianne, and who sported loose fluffy dreads and a long, often contradictory list of morals. She claimed an aversion to all unnecessary chemicals, and only organic mushrooms or locally grown wheat would do. She didn't like me, or how popular my stash made me with certain male inhabitants of Hall 16. But she was smart enough to know dobbing me in would lose her what friends and social credibility she had. She didn't need me like all the others. Niggle. But there were enough minor STDs, morning after emergencies, and ill-begotten illnesses to fill my hands, and even quite often line my pockets. See, some of my students needed something a little harder to come by. Like delectable Derek, for whom I'd spent hours online painstakingly purchasing a bumper supply of rather illegal Adderall. It arrived 4 days before his big exam. When I gave it to him, I think he almost cried. The contraband pills must have had the desired focusing effect, because the following Thursday he grabbed me in the union during a post-exam piss-up and kissed me. Clearly off his, presumably waxed, tits, he bowled me round. And I'll admit I enjoyed it. Mere moments later, a pint was held out to shining Derek and I was set back on my feet, although his arm remained around my waist. On looking up, I found myself the recipient of a gargantuan glare from Equinox, who was, I knew, so very close. As close as Derek had been, at least, to failing her exams. Who had, in fact, used her marks as an excuse for oh-so-intimate study sessions with the very same delectable individual. I ran a finger over the sharp edges of the Clipton trim blister packs of double doses that lined my handbag just in case. I luxuriated in Derek's indifferent hug. In my humble opinion, it was a mood stabiliser Equinox was in need of. But it was Adderall she came for in the middle of the night, I refrained from commenting on the crumbling of her principles. In fact, I almost felt sorry for her when I handed over what Derek didn't need. But above all, I was gratified to finally be the chemical helper of the whole hallway. Triumphantly, my head full of the joys of a second year as mistress of medicine, and perhaps a few stray thoughts of delectable Derek's wax tits, I retired to bed, where I slept beautifully until I was woken by a sharp morning knock. I rolled into my dressing gown, whose pockets crinkled with the 10- and 20-pound notes I hadn't yet remembered to bank, and readied myself for the daily pampering of angry, anorexic Angelica. Instead, I swung the door open to 3 grim-faced men, who invited themselves in. In the drone of their voices, I heard the petulant tone of Equinox, and could quickly conjure the Medusa twist of her dreads. The allegations were serious. The police involved. The cachets of carefully categorized pills pulled out one by one. This would not go well. I smiled winsomely and slipped a stray Valium under my tongue. It came enough to set my inner spindle turning, and I slowly teased out the story I'd missed. Equinox was not failing. She had failed. It wasn't necessary for her to hold her tongue anymore. Neither of us was to be back the next year. Doesn't it break my heart to think of Hall 16 and all those silly second years with no one to tend to their needs and only the shelf and a half of painkillers, condoms and cough syrups in the student shop to rely on? Still, I've had my eyes opened. Maybe I have Equinox to thank after all. There's surely nowhere I'd be as needed as I am here. And you have no idea how far little ingenuity, a well-developed desire to please, and some basic pharmaceutical knowledge will get you on the women's wing of HMP High Point.
So that was your story. Would you like to tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write it?
Well, that one I actually wrote specifically for Illicit Ink when I found out that there was a medicine-related theme for one of the events. I went away and spent some time scratching my head trying to think of something. And it just popped into my head one day that I wanted to write about someone having a very unethical way of distributing medicine, I suppose.
It does do good play with the kind of reverse drug dealer sort of kind of aspect.
Yeah, I think she likes to think that she's on the good team.
In keeping with the medicine theme, you used to work in a doctor's surgery for a short period of time. Did you pick up any good anecdotes?
I did work in a doctor's surgery. I don't know if I picked up any kind of repeatable anecdotes. I was only about, I can't remember, about 16 or 17 at the time, so it was a bit of a kind of sharp learning curve for me. Things I remember being quite shocked at were the doctors smoking in their cars. Funny looks you used to get when you used the pens the drug reps gave you, because they gave out these pens for free and they had like Prozac or Viagra or whatever emblazoned on the side, and I'd take them out and use them. And the other thing was having to check the toilets at the end of the night before locking up for junkies or people or thieves who were going to rob the prescription pans. So it was quite an interesting experience.
In kind of talking about your development as a writer, can you remember what the first thing you wrote was?
I actually can't remember at all the first thing that I wrote. I do remember, kind of doing things in primary school, kind of like, you know, what you did on your summer holidays. But the first kind of project that I remember was I had this when I was really small at my grand's house. I had a little Postman Pat's. It was like a push-along toy that you sat on and you could open up the back and put letters in it. And I wrote a bunch of letters and then made a parcel for them to go in. And then I called them like lost letters. And they were meant to be some, you know, big epic letters that a postman had thrown in the ditch or something, and everyone's lives was ruined because of it. I think that was the first thing that
That's
was
quite adorable, really.
And one of the letters was meant to be to someone who'd written a novel that would have been a bestseller, and it was an agent saying, "Your novel's been accepted," but my story was that the author never got it, and then they spent their life miserable.
I mean, so kind of following on from that, what kind of, can you remember when you kind of first thought you wanted to be a writer?
I can't definitely, but I think I was quite young when I first thought I wanted to be a writer, because I think there was a whole phase when I wanted to be like a ballet dancer, you know, all kinds of other things. But the first time I thought of it, I must have been quite young, because my grandma wrote, and I think I always wanted to, you know, I always had it in the back of my mind because she'd tell me these amazing stories, and I think I always wanted to do that. I wanted to be like that.
So you've been working as a copywriter for a number of years now. How do you suppose all that corporate writing and all that kind of writing to form has affected your fiction writing?
I think in a way it's made me worry a bit about becoming a lazy fiction writer, because I shouldn't say this, but in corporate copy, or in I do a lot of web copy, and you can, if you once you've been doing it for a while, you can do a lot of it almost on autopilot, because you become very used to, I don't know, to, I don't want to say churn, but yeah, you become very used to churning it out. You know the kind of rule, the set rules, and you need to fulfill them, and you know it can become quite a repetitive thing. And I worried that that would like bleed into my fiction, and that I'd be lazy and not, you know, not look for the best word kind of thing. But it's definitely improved my typing skills, I have to say. I can type a lot faster.
Which do you suppose takes more imagination? Conversations I've had with copywriters, they say that they have to work a lot harder on the copy because it's something which is ironically so much more boring. So they have to think a lot harder about how to make it interesting. Whereas if you're writing a story which you're really passionate about, there's less direct effort involved.
I think it probably depends a lot on the copy, because there's some copy that doesn't particularly need to be interesting, because it's there, it's very informational, and people are going directly just to get the facts, and they don't actually want it to be creative or you know, like, because I do a lot of web copy, and there's things like people hate puns, and kind of all the things that I love doing are the kind of opposite of what people want from a web page. So it can be quite difficult kind of stripping things out, but I definitely find it easier than being creative.
Okay, so what is it you like about performing stories?
It's terrifying. I think the best thing is probably that kind of buzzy feeling you get when you sit back down afterwards and you've done it and it's over. Especially if people clap, that's very nice. Also, if it's kind of going well, then you sometimes get a little moment where you can feel almost quite powerful. You get to see the reaction of people, and feel a reaction that you wouldn't normally get when you're at home kind of scribbling away. That's really nice.
So do you think there's a kind of transformative element of how a story works when it's on the page and how it works when it's performed that kind of can improve a story, perhaps?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it there's definitely different types of stories, and there's some that are amazing read aloud that don't really work on the page. And then I do think there's also stories that are amazing on the page and just don't really work as a performance piece, partly because of the length of the style, or it's got very dense language and people can't they just don't have the kind of ability to absorb it all when it's being spoken to them, maybe. Or maybe I've just got short attention span, I don't know.
Okay, moving on. This is a question lots of people dread. But do you have any favourite writers or stories?
I do, I've got loads. I suppose one writer I really admire, Ali Smith. She's one of my favourite writers. I like Janice Galloway. Tom Wolfe, I really like. There's one, it's Annie Proulx. I love her, but I don't actually know how you pronounce her last name. So I've just had like a million conversations where I'm like, do you know the Shipping News, the Accordion Diaries? You know, she's great. Because I just learn her name and then instantly forget it.
All right, moving on to kind of your working as a writer and so on. What do you think of the Edinburgh literary scene? Do you think it's supportive or do you think it's damaging? Do you think it's kind of reductionist? Would you change anything if you could?
To be honest, I actually really like it, and I only even realised that we had a scene woefully late, like only a few years ago. And I was actually really pleased to find it, and to find so many friendly people in it. I think I'd always just assumed that if there was any kind of scene, it was only for people who were very well established and published, and you know, you wouldn't be allowed in if you were like an amateur or whatever. But it doesn't seem to be like that at all. It's really nice, and it's great to have so many kind of different groups, you know, people like yourselves and you know, Inky Fingers. But, you know, it's really great. I mean, I suppose the only thing I would probably change is just having more venues, because there's not that many nice places to read anymore.
You on your blog have written up a list of office survival tips for creatives who are stuck in the humdrum world of 9 to 5 and black coffee. Is there any kind of like top tip you'd like to give our listeners?
My top tip to staying creative in an office is probably just to drink all the coffee. And you just try and enjoy. I mean, you know, it can be horrible, but there are loads of different things you can pick up, and like watching people's relationships play out, and those like awful email chains where you see people blaming other people, and it's just like hours of stupidity just playing out in front of you. Like, that's actually gold. You can use that one day.
Yeah. And is there any particular message of hope that you can have people take away from their work in an office?
No, it's kind of a tough one these days because, you know, there's not a lot of hope in the job market. So I'd actually be happy to be, you know, it'd almost be the other way around. You'd be hoping to get the job in the office because it's so dire out there at the moment. But I think probably the kind of the discipline of, you know, turning up and doing something that you don't like for 8 hours a day is quite good if you want to just be able to do 8 hours of writing or 8 hours of editing or 8 hours of making revisions you don't want to make. Like,
Basically, teaching people that work isn't fun
yeah.
and nobody is happy to see.
Well, yeah.
So, what have you been working on at the moment?
At the moment, I've been working on a novel that's kind of, it's basically about a girl that's suspected of being some kind of miracle worker or healer, in this kind of small, quite depressed Scottish coastal town. And it's basically about how this belief affects the kind of small community around her.
All right then, to wrap up, and in keeping with our medical theme, could you tell us about any kind of not so scientific home remedies you use?
It's actually kind of a tough one because I was trying to think of them and I was like, well, I think I'm really quite normal. Like, everything's just paracetamol or ibuprofen or whatever. But the only one I could think of was eating sherbet to cure a sore stomach. Because it works if the problem is that you've not got enough acid in your stomach. It's got a kind of killer cure because if you're
Yeah.
already acidic, then it can make you throw up, but it can also cure
And it means you get
sluggish.
to have flying saucers as well.
Exactly, you
You take all
do.
your
Or
sherbet
sherbet
as I do.
fountains.
Yes, or
Or dib dabs. Oh,
you did
there's
that.
so many awesome sherbets.
Great. Well, okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that's all from us at Listing for now. Many thanks to our guest writer, Lindsay May, and thanks to you for listening. Don't forget that if you want to learn more about us or our readers, you can check us out at listing.net. I've been Tom Moore, and I hope very much to speak at you again. Goodbye.